On the way in this morning, you should have gotten one of these stickers right here, and you should have gotten an official Summit pin, which also, by the way, I think is the official pin of waiters and waitresses all throughout the Triangle, based on how many times I see it in a restaurant. So I appreciate you using them that way. That's not exactly what we bought them for, but hey, it's not bad, right? But you'll need both of these at some point in the message, so I hope that you have them, and we'll take them out. And if you have your Bibles this morning also, if you will meet me in Luke chapter 19. Luke chapter 19, they say never to meet your heroes, but I had the chance to meet one of mine when I was in middle school, the one and only Michael Jordan. It was at the Crosby Golf Tournament in 1986. I know some of you have heard this story, but we got a lot of new people at our church, right? So everybody needs to hear it. Michael Jordan was at the height of his career. I think he had been with the Chicago Bulls maybe 3 years at this point. I was in the eighth grade, and all I wanted in life was to be able to meet Michael Jordan. And so I found out I was gonna be at this golf tournament, so my best friend and I, who had no interest in golf whatsoever, bought tickets to this tournament and spent the whole day trying to figure out where he was. The tournament organizers, I think, wisely did not publish where he was so that there wasn't a mob to keep Jordan away from people like me. And so I never saw him the entire day, no spotting of Michael Jordan. So at the very end of the day, I was waiting for my mom to come pick up me and my best friend, and we were outside one of the refreshment tents, and my friend was buying a Snickers bar or something. And all of a sudden, I see coming down that road, I see this purple Porsche Carrera 944, and I was enough of a Michael Jordan fanboy to know that's his car. So I turned and yelled at my friend. I'm like, it's him. It's Michael Jordan. And I guess, 50, 60 people heard me. So this little group comes over, and Michael Jordan is coming down the path in this car, and he rolls that tinted window down. He's looking for somebody. It's not me, but he's looking for somebody. And he comes right by where I'm standing, and the window is all the way down. And my friend sees his opportunity. And so he grabs me by the top and the bottom of my back of my shirt, and he shoves me into Michael Jordan's car. This is not a joke. I'm waist deep up into his car. I am this close to Michael Jordan's face. I could have licked him. And one of my lifelong regrets is that I did not carpe diem right then. But I said, hello, Mr. Jordan. And he was sitting there, his arm, on the way, and he looks over and he says, get out of my car. And I said, yes, sir, Mr. Jordan. And I backed out of the car and I turned around to the crowd and I said, he talked to me. Michael Jordan and I had a conversation. It was the pinnacle moment of my middle school career. Everything from that point on was downhill. But overall, that meeting did not have much ongoing effect on me. Today, you're going to see a man fight through the crowd just to get a glimpse of Jesus. And you're going to see the effect that meeting Jesus has on him. We've been in a series called Whatever It Takes, where we have focused on what following Jesus means specifically in regard to our time, our treasure, and our talents. Today we're going to round out our study by considering the effect that actually meeting Jesus has on generosity. Not just generosity with your money, but just generosity of spirit in general. Luke chapter 19, if you got your Bibles, all 4 weeks of this series, in case you haven't noticed, have come from the Gospel of Luke. And so we're gonna round out this series. We're gonna finish it up with Luke chapter 19 this week. This is one of the greatest little stories in the Bible. It's about a wee little man. And it's important to see that this story, where it takes place in the Gospel of Luke, is almost right after Jesus's encounter with the rich young ruler that we looked at just a few weeks ago. And in order to really understand what this story is doing, you gotta understand its connection to that story. In that story, a rich young ruler had tragically walked away from Jesus sad because he could not let go of his possessions. And as that rich young ruler was walking away, Jesus turned to his disciples. Do you remember this? And he said to them, truly, truly, I say to you, it's easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than it is for a rich person to enter into the kingdom of heaven. And when he said that, his disciples had looked back and responded. And they said, well, then who then can be saved? And Jesus's answer was, what is impossible with men is possible with God. Zacchaeus's story is the answer to that dilemma. Because in Zacchaeus's story, we're gonna have another rich young ruler. But this one, even though he is far more compromised than the other one, this rich young ruler does respond the right way and thereby enters into the kingdom of heaven. So you are about to see what it looks like for a camel to go through the eye of a needle. And you're gonna see how God saves the impossible. This is the answer to the dilemma Jesus raised in Luke 18. Luke chapter 19, verse 1. As Jesus entered Jericho, there was a man there named Zacchaeus. He was an archetelonus, literally chief of the tax collectors. And he was rich, and he was seeking to see who Jesus was. I have to wonder personally, what was it that made Zacchaeus want to see Jesus? Was it just curiosity? Was it a troubled conscience? We just don't know. I have a suspicion what it was, which I will get to in a moment. But the bottom line is we don't know exactly what it was that drove him to seek Jesus out. But the next detail is awesome. But on account of the crowd, he could not see Jesus because he was vertically challenged. He was small of stature. Small of stature in Greek is literally wee little man, all right? All right, how many of you grew up with a song? Let's just go ahead and acknowledge it. Zacchaeus was a wee little man and a... There you go. And everybody who wasn't in church growing up was like, what in the world was that? But it's true, y'all. It's true. That's where we get the song from. He was a wee little man. He was a wee little man. So he ran on up ahead and he climbed up into a sycamore tree to see him, for he was about, Jesus was about to pass that way. Why does he climb the tree? You say, well, duh, because he's short. He's a wee little man, and a wee little man was he, so he climbed up into the sycamore tree for the Lord he wanted to see. But y'all, here's the thing. When somebody's short, you don't mind if they stand in front of you. When my kids and I are in a crowd, I don't mind if they stand in front of me because they don't affect my line of sight. But this crowd won't let Zacchaeus in, even though he's short, even though he won't affect their line of sight, because they hate him. And that's because they hated all tax collectors. You say, well, why? Well, I mean, I wouldn't say that tax collector is the most popular job today, but back then it was the worst thing that you could be. By the way, I read an article recently that explained that the term IRS agent has become so unpopular in our culture that in some parts of the country, IRS agents have adopted the new name compliance directors. And I thought, oh yeah, that's a lot better. Some compliance director, somebody over there in marketing is just killing it, okay? So tax collector, compliance director might not be the most popular job today, but back then, to be a tax collector was the worst thing you could do because tax collectors were considered to be traitors and thieves. You see, the Romans had come up with a pretty ingenious tax system. After they conquered a people, they wanted to tax the people so they could get rich off of them. That's why they conquered the people. But they found that if they transplanted a Roman official there to collect the tax, he wouldn't really be able to do it because not only was he unpopular, he didn't understand the city well enough to know where all the real money was hidden. For example, imagine a tax agent from another country got sent here to America to collect taxes from waiters and restaurants. And so he demands to see at the end of every night, he demands to see each waiter's paycheck to take taxes out of that. But he doesn't understand that the real money that a waiter makes comes not from his hourly wage, it comes from his tips. An insider would know that. The Romans wanted an insider who knew where the real money was hiding. And so they paid local Jews to do their dirty work for them. And they told them, hey, this is how much tax Rome wants. Anything you get beyond that, you can keep for yourself. Here's a garrison of Roman soldiers to help you enforce that. So Jewish tax collectors extracted these huge amounts of money from their own people for Rome, who was oppressing their people, and they got rich in the process. And anybody who resisted them would get roughed up by the Roman soldiers. Tax collectors did this to their neighbors. They did this to their friends. They did this to their former elementary school teachers. They did this to their grandmothers. Y'all, imagine that. When you chose to become a tax collector, you chose to get rich off of the suffering of your neighbors. Money was so important to you that you would sacrifice everything, your country, your integrity, your family, everything just to get it. Tax collectors were so despised that the Jewish Mishnah, which was basically an ancient commentary on Jewish laws, the Jewish Mishnah said that lying to a tax collector was okay. One source said that was because tax collectors were not really people. They were like animals, and according to Jewish law, lying to animals is not a sin. which is a weird clarification if you ask me. So not okay. It's okay to lie to your pet. Don't lie to your spouse. You can lie to your pet. You for sure, by the way, should lie to your cat because your cat is definitely lying to you. Okay, I know they rub up against your leg like they like you, but while you're sleeping, they fantasize about your early demise. Science has proven that. Maybe some studies show. Okay, but point is, cats and tax collectors go in the same category. The point is, this is Zacchaeus, y'all. In most people's eyes, he is subhuman. He's subhuman. And Jericho, by the way, where Zacchaeus is the chief tax collector, that was the richest city in Israel. That was their New York City. This is not your run-of-the-mill rich guy. This guy sits at the top office, in the top office, in the tallest skyscraper in their version of Manhattan. As far as they're concerned, this is the worst of the worst. So when they see him trying to press through the crowds, they're like, we're not moving for you, you wee little pig of a man. And so after trying unsuccessfully for several minutes to worm his way in between their knees, he's running short on options, all right? So he decides to branch out, okay? I'm gonna go ahead and warn you, my pun game is on point this morning, okay? So brace yourself, all right? Hey, y'all, what a sight. What a sight this must have been, right? I mean, think about it. As far as riches goes, Zacchaeus was the Elon Musk or the Mark Zuckerberg of his day. He's used to being carried around in a chariot by servants, and here you got him climbing up into a tree like he's a middle school fanboy trying to stick his head in a Porsche to get a quick glimpse of his hero. I mean, imagine if one of those guys did that today. You look up in a crowd and you see a desperate Elon Musk hanging off of a limb just trying to get a glimpse of Jesus. I would say there's something here that all of us can learn from Zacchaeus, right? This is not even the main point of the message, but let's just acknowledge it. Zacchaeus is willing to do whatever it takes to see Jesus. And let me just point out to those of you who might be seeking Jesus this morning, Zacchaeus does not let Jesus's hypocritical, judgmental, self-righteous followers discourage him from getting that view. I just feel like that might be a word for somebody in here right now. Maybe you're gonna have to climb a tree to get above Jesus's followers so that you can see him. It ought not be like that. And I apologize that sometimes it is like that, but maybe you felt crowded out by the way that some of Jesus's followers act about politics on social media. Or maybe you've experienced some followers of Jesus to be really cliquish or standoffish. Or maybe they've made racial or sexist jokes around you in a way that really turned you off. Maybe you were in business with a Christian and they really did you wrong. Maybe you've even suffered abuse at the hands of somebody who claimed to be a Christian. I don't know. But church, I don't want to be the kind of people who keeps a Zacchaeus from getting a good glimpse of Jesus. That's like our whole ministry philosophy here. Don't make it hard for people who are looking for Jesus to get a glimpse of him. Point is, maybe that's you. You've been hurt by Jesus's followers and you got to climb up above them to get a good look at him. All I'll tell you is that it's worth it. Because watch what happens next in verse 5. And when Jesus came to the place, he looked up and he said, Zacchaeus, you come down, for I'm going to your house today. Now, this almost seems a little presumptuous on Jesus' part, right? Hey, strange little man I've never talked to before. I'm inviting myself to dinner at your house tonight, and I'll probably spend the night. Y'all, what is it? What is it that makes Jesus know how to pick somebody out of a crowd? It's the only person Jesus said that to this day. What is it about him that knows how to pick somebody out of a crowd and say, you? I know God is at work in your life. We see it not only in this story, all throughout the Gospels, Jesus has this ability to walk through a crowd and stop and see right into somebody's heart and say, I see you. And I know what's going on inside of you. I suspect that might be happening to some of you right now. You never thought you'd be in here. In fact, you can't really believe you are here, but you are. And you're trying to hide out there somewhere in the crowd. Or maybe you chose to go to one of our campuses because you thought, well, I'll go where the teaching pastor is not even physically present because there's no way he can, you know, mess with me there. I'm definitely safe here. But you're just trying to get a little look at Jesus. And today you're going to sense Jesus call you out of that hiding spot and say, you, I see you and I'm looking for you. So he hurried down, Zacchaeus hurried down. And he stood and he came and he received him joyfully. There is a scandalous order to this story that every Jewish listener would have picked up on immediately. You see, in those days, to eat with somebody, To go to someone's house and share a meal was a sign of intimate fellowship. That's true even in our American context. To share your dinner table with somebody is to share your life. I invite friends and people I know over to, you know, dinner. It's not normally strangers or enemies that I'm inviting to my table. It's somebody that I have a relationship with. But it was especially true in that culture. To eat with somebody meant that you were accepting them, that you were committing yourself in a way to a loving relationship with them. Here's the scandalous order. Jesus chose to eat with Zacchaeus before Zacchaeus cleaned up his life. When Jesus came over for dinner, Zacchaeus was still a cheating, practicing tax collector. That's why verse 7 says that they were all scandalized. And when the Jewish leaders saw it, they all grumbled. He has gone in to be the guest of a man who is a sinner. They would have thought that a holy person, a representative of God, a holy God, if he had anything to say to Zacchaeus, it would have been to command Zacchaeus to go clean up his life. And look at all the oppression and suffering you have caused. Look at all these people around you you've hurt. You need to make it up to them. You go clean up your life, you make amends, and then later, after Zacchaeus had made sufficient amends, maybe, only maybe, then Jesus might eat with him. But Jesus enters Zacchaeus' house first before Zacchaeus changes. But y'all see, this scandalous order is the heart of the gospel. Salvation comes to our houses before we change. In fact, salvation is what brings the change. Every other religion in the world would have said to Zacchaeus, Zacchaeus, if you want to find God, clean up your life, start being honest, give away your money, go and do those things, and then you'll find salvation. But Jesus reversed the order. Salvation invites itself to dinner at your house. It knocks at your door. All you got to do is open the door and receive it, and in response, you change. And boy, did Zacchaeus ever change. Verse 8, Zacchaeus stood and said to the Lord, behold, Lord, half of my goods I give to the poor, and if I have defrauded anybody of anything, I restore it fourfold. Did y'all notice? I didn't skip any verses between verses 7 and 8. There are no commands from Jesus. There's no belittling, no shame, no how could you? You better do this. Just the experience of grace changed Zacchaeus. And Zacchaeus stood up spontaneously, unprompted by anybody else. And he said, I'm going to repay anything I have ever stolen fourfold. And I'm going to give away half of all my goods to the poor on top of that. Now, the Jewish law specified what you were required to repay somebody if you stole from them. And Zacchaeus surely would have known these laws. Leviticus says basically it was the value of the object plus 20%. In other words, if you stole somebody's cow, you had to repay them the value of the cow and then add 20%. That's like what? A cow plus a tomahawk steak from Angus Barn? The value of the cow plus 20%. That's utterly appropriate, okay? All right, I warned you. But Zacchaeus repays four times the value. Four times, no one required him to do that. He does it voluntarily. And the part about him giving away 50%, that is nowhere in the law. That's just gravy. That just springs forth spontaneously out of his heart. And the thing to notice, y'all, he does it all with glee. Not drudgery, not how much do I have to do to make this right. He does it with glee. In fact, there's a little nuance in Greek that you might miss because it doesn't translate into English. Verse 8, he says, look, Lord, look, I'm giving away 50%. And the syntax in Greek is like a kid who was showing his mom and dad how he could ride his bike without holding on to the handlebars. Look, Daddy, look at what I'm doing. Look at me. You see, it's not just Zacchaeus' behavior that's changed. He has changed. What the Jewish law had been utterly unable to compel, the grace of the gospel produced in an instant. The law tells us what we ought to do. But the gospel changes our heart so that we want to do it. The law is like the railroad tracks pointing us in the direction that we should go, but powerless to move the freight along the tracks. The gospel is the power that moves the load. The law commands us to act like God, and in the process just reveals how utterly unwilling and unable we are to do that. The gospel transforms us so that we become like God, so that we obey his commandments from the heart. Or to quote Martin Luther, the law says do, but it's never done. The gospel says only believe, rejoice, because it's already done. Verse 9, and Jesus said to him, today salvation has come to this house, since he also is the son of Abraham, for the Son of Man came to seek and to save the lost. Zacchaeus is supposed to be an example of how all people find Jesus, or better yet, are found by him, and what happens to them when they do. So in light of that, I want us to consider two questions with our remaining time. Number one, what was it that brought the change in Zacchaeus? Number two, what was the sign of the change? What brought the change? What was the sign of the change? Number one, what brought about the change in Zacchaeus? Zacchaeus's awakening, as I see it, was basically twofold. First, he recognized the emptiness of money. I mean, y'all think about it. Something drove Zacchaeus to climb that tree. Something gave him the inner compulsion, I gotta do something, and I gotta do something radical because things aren't working. There he was, having achieved all that he'd ever hoped to achieve, and still he felt empty, unsettled. Proverbs 11:25 says that the righteous eats to the satisfying of their souls. But the stomach of the ungodly, no matter how much they eat, no matter how much they eat and devour, they always crave more. Zacchaeus had eaten his fill, but he still craved more. He was unhappy. They say that throughout his life, Robin Williams confessed to being deeply unhappy, despite the fact that he was regarded as one of the most successful comics of all time. He started with that hit sitcom, Mork and Mindy. That won several awards. And then he went on from there to not just star in one or two culture-defining movies, but several culture-defining movies. He proved what Ralph Waldo Emerson often said, that humor is always the mistress of sorrow. Humor is often, the mistress of sorrow. Those who worked with Robin Williams said that offstage he was sullen and morose. Zach, his son, said his moods would rise and fall with the movie reviews or based on how everybody was talking about somebody else. Robin Williams once told his wife, "You're only as good as your last performance." Towards the end of his life, Robin Williams was so distraught that he confided to a friend that he didn't know how to be funny anymore. "I don't know how to be funny anymore." And finally, tragically, you know this, he decided to end it all by hanging himself. Maybe there's something in that story that resonates with you. I don't mean necessarily that you're suicidal, although that could potentially be true, but maybe there's something in that that resonates with you. You've given your life to pursue some dream, and now you've gotten it, or at least you've gotten a part of it, but it still leaves you unsettled. Maybe it's time that you recognize that what you've given your life to pursue may not deliver what you thought it would. Maybe you've got to acknowledge there's an emptiness there that you weren't expecting to find when you got there. Pastor Joby Martin, who was here a few weeks ago, talks about how when he first moved to Jacksonville, Florida, he got invited to the dog racing track there. Now, we don't have those in Raleigh that I know about, but it's Jacksonville, and there's different down there. You know that. So Joby told me that the best moment of every race, first race he was at, the best moment, he says, when the dogs are at the gates and they're ready to race, and the announcer, he says, comes on the loudspeaker and just bellows out, "Here's Rusty!" And Joby said when he said that, he didn't know what was going on, but everybody started cheering, and then a fake rabbit popped up out onto the track right in front of those gates and shot down the straightaway along a little railway. Joby said, man, when those dogs saw Rusty, they lost their ever-loving canine minds. They would start barking and jumping and banging up against the doors of those cages. And when they let down those gates, those dogs tore off after that fake rabbit like they'd been fired out of a cannon. And they chased Rusty all the way around that track to the very end when suddenly Rusty suddenly disappeared back into a hole in the ground. And Joby said, I'm sure later in the kennel, the dogs are like, man, I was so close this time. I almost had him. I mean, he was right there. And their dog friends are like, yeah, gosh, me too. Man, you ever think we'll have a chance at Rusty again? Sure enough, next day, Rusty's back. And off they go after him again, only to have him disappear again right before they catch him. And they repeat this routine every single weekend. Do they never learn? Now we say, what dumb dogs. But y'all consider this. Every day your alarm clock goes off, and it's almost like that alarm clock is bellowing out, here's Rusty! And off you go out of bed in pursuit of your version of Rusty. The promotion, the corner office, the new boyfriend, the new car, the grade. Joby said the worst moments are those rare times when one of the dogs, happens every once in a while, will actually catch Rusty. malfunction in the track, or maybe the dogs are super fast, faster than they thought, and he gets it. The object of his greatest desire, his lifelong pursuit, and he chews into it, and he says, wait a minute. This isn't what I thought it was. I've been duped. That dog, Joby says, will never run in quite the same way again. And that's where the dogs might actually be a little smarter than us, because some of you caught Rusty. You moved into the new house. You got the corner office. You got the car. You chewed into it and you thought, well, that was disappointing. There must be another Rusty out there somewhere that I need. This Rusty was not what I thought it was, but I'm sure the next one will be the actual rabbit. Zacchaeus got a glimpse. Zacchaeus had caught Rusty and he chewed into it and he realized how empty money was. But instead of just saying, it must be something else on earth that I need, he did what C.S. Lewis would say is he realized that if there was nothing in this world that could satisfy him, he must be created for another world. And so he learned from the emptiness of money, but even more, he got a glimpse of something from another world. He got a glimpse of how glorious Jesus is. He saw the emptiness of money. That's the first thing. Then he saw the gloriousness of Jesus. Here was a Savior who loved Zacchaeus when nobody else would, who sought him up in a tree when nobody else would even let him be a part of the crowd. Here was a person, Jesus, who had no need of Zacchaeus because this man could work miracles. He could walk on water. He could heal the sick. He could raise the dead. He did not need any of Zacchaeus's money. And yet, he sought out Zacchaeus, a man so despised that people would not even make room for him in a crowd. And that experience of grace broke money's hold over Zacchaeus. Zacchaeus had not become a tax collector, you see. He didn't become a tax collector because he was inwardly more dishonest than other people. He became a tax collector because money had this spell over him. Zacchaeus believed that money represented the good life. And Zacchaeus thought, if I've got to compromise my integrity, if I got to burn a few relationships or all my relationships to get money, well, that's just the price. But I know that what's waiting for me there, I know it's going to be worth it. His sin was driven by his idolization of money. By the way, the same is true with your sins, whether they're money or something else. If romance is your idol, if you see titillating romance and exciting sex as essential to the good life, well, if you got to step outside of marriage, if you got to compromise your morals to get it, and you can get away with it, then you probably will. It's not usually that you're inwardly some overly craven, lustful person. You're just held captive by the spell of romance. If you see the respect of your friends as essential to your happiness, and you got to compromise yourself to earn that respect, you probably will. You're under the spell of your friends' opinions. They hold you captive. Zacchaeus had lived all of his life under the spell of money, but see, then he met Jesus, and that experience broke money's spell over him because he found in Jesus a greater treasure than he had sought for in money. Thomas Chalmers, an old Puritan, preached a famous sermon called The Expulsive Power of a New Affection. And what he meant by all that was, he says, the only way to overcome sinful desires is by replacing them with a stronger desire. The expulsive power of a new affection. When you find an affection that is larger than your sinful desires, you will find all of your sinful desires begin to come under control. Think about it like this. I've done a lot of weddings in my lifetime, as you could imagine. And one of the things that I've noticed is that quite often the bride and the groom will forget to eat at the reception, despite the fact that they are ravenously hungry, and despite the fact that they're just a few feet away from an all-expenses-paid buffet of the finest foods they've probably ever been around. And that is because the reason they don't even notice that they're hungry is because they're so enraptured with the joy of the moment that they forget to eat. In all my years of doing weddings, I've never one time had a groom look at me when those doors open and the bride is walking down the aisle. I've never had one look at me and say, hey, man, you got a Snickers? I am so hungry right now. No, the expulsive power of a new affection. All lesser affections are brought into captivity by a stronger one. See, the problem is not that your sinful desires are too strong. The problem is that your desire for God is so weak. The only way to become an honest person, the only way to become a truly generous person, the only way to become a sexually pure person is for your wonder of Jesus to grow. And how does that happen? Is it because I command you to? Is it because, you know, you just like, you feel so bad about yourself that you got to make some changes? No. As with Zacchaeus, you get a taste of glorious grace. That's what changes you. The law can tell you what you should be like. Only the gospel can make it true. See, here's the thing. Zacchaeus didn't see the half of it, did he? See, you and I can read this story from a vantage point that even Zacchaeus did not have. Zacchaeus climbed up in a tree seeking Jesus, but in just a couple of chapters, Jesus would climb up into a tree seeking Zacchaeus. But Jesus wasn't climbing up into a sycamore tree just to be able to get a better vantage point of Zacchaeus. He was climbing up in a tree to take Zacchaeus' place and to die for his sins. You see, there was an Old Testament reference that every Jew would have known. Deuteronomy 21, 23, cursed, despised is everyone who is hung on a tree. Jesus climbed up into a tree so he could take Zacchaeus' place of cursing, so he could be despised in Zacchaeus' place, and then extend intimacy and fellowship to Zacchaeus in its place. Jesus traded places with Zacchaeus. Jesus experienced the shame so that Zacchaeus could receive the acceptance. Jesus took the curse so Zacchaeus could reap the blessing. Jesus told Zacchaeus to come down from that tree of shame so that he, Jesus, could climb up into it. And when Zacchaeus saw that and he tasted it, just a taste of it, it changed him. Some of you have come back to church thinking, well, I got to get my life back together. I got to start doing better. I gotta start making amends for some of the wrong that I've done. I gotta go back to the way I was when I was younger. I've gotta remove this life of shame. Then maybe I can be a good person again, and maybe I can earn my way back into God's favor. Maybe you had a relative die, and you're like, I gotta do it for mom, I gotta do it for dad. But salvation, you see, is a gift you can only receive. Jesus took your curse, he paid your debt, and now salvation knocks at your door. All you can do is open it and receive him. That's why Jesus said, Revelation 3:20, behold, I stand at the door and knock. If any man hears my voice and opens the door, I'll come in and I'll eat with him. The same invitation that Jesus extended to Zacchaeus, he extends to you, because see, you and I are just like Zacchaeus. Zacchaeus was too short to see Jesus. Think about that. He had to climb a tree to get to him. Romans says that I'm too short to see God, for all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. So God climbed a tree to get to me. But that tree was not a beautiful sycamore on the road to Jerusalem. That tree was a bloody cross on the crest of Golgotha. Was it for crimes that I had done? He groaned upon that tree. Amazing pity, grace unknown, and love beyond degree. But drops of grief could never repay the debt of love I owe. Here, Lord, I give myself away. It's all that I can do, which is what Zacchaeus did, right? Zacchaeus was like, here's all I have. Drops of grief could never repay. Here's everything I have. Which leads me to question two. What was the sign of Zacchaeus' change? Two things again here, two things. First is a yearning for justice. Second is an impulse for generosity. A yearning for justice and an impulse for generosity. First, Zacchaeus had an immediate yearning to overcome injustice. He's like, I gotta make things right. I gotta make things right. First with God, second with others. So far as we can tell, nobody commanded him to do that. Instinctively, it's just what he wanted to do. Sometimes people think they can come to Jesus and stay the same. Pray a little prayer like a get out of hell free card. Get baptized, cross yourself, move on. The first sign of meeting Jesus is a desire for justice. Justice with God, justice with others, especially where you've been the one that's wronged somebody. Where you've wronged somebody, you wanna make it right. You wanna start living honorably before God and before others. A desire to live in secrecy and bend the rules so long as you don't get caught, those are signs of darkness, not light. It's like the Apostle John says, any man who says that he knows him and continues in sin is a liar. If we say we have fellowship with him and we actually walk in darkness, we lie and do not practice the truth. So the first sign of having met Jesus is a yearning for justice. The second sign is what we see in Zacchaeus, an impulse for generosity. It's like I noted, Zacchaeus went well beyond the justice requirements of the law. Instead of, you know, paying back value plus 20%, he pays back four times. And then on top of that, he gives away 50% of the poor. He did that because not because he had to, but because grace moved him to do that. Sometimes when we get into conversations about why relationships in our lives are strained, when I'm talking with somebody, all we talk about is justice. Well, the reason we're not getting along is because they did that, or they accused me of that, and I didn't do that, or it wasn't that bad, and I don't owe them anything. They shouldn't be treating me like this. We're like that when we think about our marriages, right? The reason we're having problems is because she does this. I don't deserve that. We're like that with our roommates. Well, they're such a jerk here, and they're not pulling their weight here, and I'm always having to clean this up. We're like that in our jobs. Well, I'm owed this, and I wasn't giving my full due here, and that's wrong, and I'm being treated wrong. We're like that even in our, societal, racial discussions. Well, I'm being held responsible for what my ancestors did, and that's not my fault. And that's all true if we're talking about justice. But the Christian goes beyond justice to mercy. The Christian asks different kinds of questions, right? You understand, the Christians ask different questions than they do on CNN and Fox News. They begin to say things like, what do I have by which I can lift others up? How can I use whatever position of power I have to pour myself out? I don't want to merely repay what I owe. I want to give back four times as much. That just comes out of my heart because that's what the gospel does in somebody. An impulse for grace is the sign that grace has actually changed you. I think my favorite parable of Jesus that illustrates this is that story of the man. You should be familiar with it, but the story of the man who was forgiven 10,000 talents. Now, we learned a couple weeks ago that a talent is like 2 years' salary. 10,000 talents. It's like saying 10,000 2 years' salary. That's what, 20,000 years of labor. That's a lot. Plus, 10,000 was the highest number you could count to in Greek, so it's basically like saying an infinity. It'd be like I saying a gazillion dollars. This guy owes this guy a gazillion dollars. In those days, if you couldn't pay your debt by the day it was due, you entered something they called debtor's prison. Debtor's prison is basically indentured servanthood. You became a slave of this other guy. And if you couldn't pay off your debt in your lifetime, your kids became the property of him and his kids. And this is how families would get enslaved to other families because it would go on from generation to generation until you paid your full debt. So the day in the story Jesus tells for this debt has come due. And so the guy appears in court and he walks in and they say, can you repay 10,000 talents? And all of a sudden this guy breaks down and he falls on his knees and he says, no, I don't have it, but please don't put me in a slavery. Don't take my kids into slavery. Just maybe you take me, but don't take my kids, please. Whatever you do, don't afflict my kids with this. And he begins to weep. He says, just give me one more week and I promise you I'll pay you back every penny. Now everybody listening to this story, everybody watching this scene in Jesus' story is like, this is unbelievably embarrassing. And for two reasons. One, it's not like if he has a week, he's gonna be able to pay this back, because 10,000 talents, that's like 10,000 lifetimes. Secondly, I mean, when you're the kind of person that can afford to loan somebody else that kind of money, you don't get in that position by being a pushover, right? What do we call you? Not loan puppy or loan bunny, we call you loan shark. Because if you don't pay the debt, they send somebody to your doorstep with a bat named Bruno and he's gonna, break your kneecaps. So all of a sudden you got this guy in front of the loan shark groveling and everybody's kind of shuffling their feet because they're kind of embarrassed, how awkward this is. When the story takes the most unexpected turn because Jesus says this loan shark feels this emotion that's so much better in Greek than English. The emotion is splagma. And I've told you it's onomatopoeia. Onomatopoeia means the word sounds like what it is. Splagma is supposed to sound like you're throwing up. Right, say it, okay, it's kind of fun. Say splagma. Splagma. Right, it's conjuring up this pity, just a pity that starts down here and just comes up and takes over. And so he gets misty-eyed, and I don't know what happens, but he starts shaking his head. He said, "Get up, get up, get up! No, you don't have another week to pay me back, because as of this moment, you don't owe me a dime. I am hereby forgiving all your debt, all 10,000 talents." 20,000 years of labor, I'm forgiving it right now. Nobody saw that coming. Everybody's like, what in the world just happened? This guy stands up, he's like, am I being punked? no, you're free to go. The guy walks out of the courtroom and he's like, I mean, he's just kind of dazed. And as he's walking out of the courtroom, he sees another guy crossing the street, a friend of his who owes him $2.14 for a bag of Doritos from last week. He's like, hey man, got my $2? Guy's like, man, I'm sorry, I don't have any cash on me. I'll get you next week, I promise. What? You don't have my $2? Goes over, Jesus says, and grabs him by the throat and hauls him off and throws him into debtor's prison for $2. Now, you know when Jesus gets to that point of the story, everybody's like, you know, kind of rolls their eyes. They're like, come on, man. We thought you were telling a true story. Nobody, that's so dumb. Nobody who just got forgiven a gazillion dollars is going to hold somebody else accountable for $2. And Jesus is like, exactly. Which means if you're not a person of generosity or forgiveness or grace, if all you do is insist in your marriage and in your relationships and with your money, all you insist on is what you're owed, that means you haven't really met Jesus. How do you know Jesus has come into your life? How do you know? The best indicator is your generosity of spirit. Robert Murray McShane, the Scottish pastor, 100 years ago, used to say, the more you understand who Jesus is and the more you understand what he has done for you, the more generous you become. I fear there are many that are hearing me right now who know they are not Christians because they do not love to give. To give largely and liberally, not grudging at all, requires a new heart. An old heart would rather part with its lifeblood than its money. What's your impulse for generosity say about your experience of grace? They say that pilots who fly through clouds or fog, they gotta follow their instruments, even when those instruments contradict their perceptions of which way is up, because it's so easy to get disoriented in cloud cover that if you follow your gut and not the instrument panel, you'll probably crash and die. The most reliable indicator light on your spiritual dashboard, the light that tells us whether or not you've met Jesus, is what happens in regard your heart in regards to your time, your treasure, and your talents. When you've been impacted by grace, you develop an impulse for generosity. Is your life characterized by justice? Is it characterized by mercy? Because if not, Zacchaeus would say, I don't think you could have met the same guy I met. There's just no way to encounter that kind of grace and stay the same. No way. Over the last several weeks, we've taken time to consider what relationship our hearts have with money. We've just thought about it. We've talked about it from several different angles because Jesus said that money is the number one competitor in our hearts for God. Like I said, our focus has not been on the way, excuse me, our focus has not been on the money that we need for various projects. That's not what this is about. Our focus is on what we do with, how what we do with our money indicates what we love most, what we trust the most, and who is really the Lord of our lives. This is, we're not trying to raise money for anything. I'm a pastor, not a fundraiser. Today, what we've seen is that generosity is the indicator light of how much the gospel has impacted us. The deeper we go in the gospel, the more open our hands become with our possessions. So I want to end by giving you a very tangible next step, which is this sticker. Make sure you have it out. I'm going to walk through a handful of ways the Spirit may be leading you in this in regards to your time, your talent, and your treasure. Honestly, look, the Spirit may be leading you to a generosity of heart in any of them. This doesn't have to be about your money. It does not have to be about your money. But hear me, okay? Don't leave money off the table just because it's uncomfortable. Allow the Spirit to speak directly to you. Give him free rein in your life. You'll notice that what it says is, my next step is. There's a blank. You're going to write down one or two things in that blank in the space below it in these categories, whichever ones you feel like the Spirit is saying to you. In regards to your treasure, it might be for you to start giving to the kingdom of God. Some of you have never done that. I'm not talking about just throwing lunch money in every once in a while, but I mean giving in a systematic way. That's a big step of faith. And I want to celebrate it, and I want to invite you to experience. I can remember when I started to give my first and my best of the kingdom of God. Some of you are gonna start moving toward that 10%, the tithe of giving to God, and that's great. For many of you, it's the first time you've ever done it. For some of you, it's gonna be to set up a recurring gift. My wife and I made a commitment years ago that our biggest expense every month was gonna be to the kingdom of God, and that's gonna be what you write down there. It might be to start giving sacrificially. Maybe like Zacchaeus, your response to the grace of Jesus in your life It's like, I don't want to just do what the law requires. I want to go beyond that. I want to give a radical gift that testifies my gratefulness to what Jesus has done for me. People always say, well, how much are you supposed to give? I'm like, the Bible doesn't give you an amount. That's the beauty of it. I love the words of C.S. Lewis. They've been kind of a North Star for me. The only safe way, Lewis says, the only safe rule, sorry, when it comes to generosity is to give away more than you think you can spare, because only then are you starting to give in a way that is generous and that requires trust. So it might be something in the category of your treasure. It could be something in the category of your time or your talent. Maybe for you to do whatever it takes, your next step is going to be to start serving in Summit students, serving in Summit kids to help us raise up the next generation for Christ. Maybe it's to invest in our community by serving on one of our local outreach teams. Maybe you need to start serving at your campus or join one of our prayer teams. Instead of just showing up every week as an audience member, kind of just, you know, leaning on the sacrificial efforts of everybody else, maybe it's time for you to be a part of that and put Jesus first in your time. Maybe it's to sign up for one of the 18 short-term mission trips we got going on this spring. Maybe the Lord prompted you to go overseas a couple years ago, but then the pandemic happened and all those doors closed. Maybe your next step is to renew that process and get back in that pipeline. Maybe the next step is to share the gospel with a lost neighbor, a coworker, a family member this Thanksgiving. Now you're just going to sit there and you're going to say, okay, I'm going to share the gospel with my brother, my sister, my parent, a cousin. They're going to want to argue about politics, and I'm going to try to avoid that as much as possible, and I'm going to try to get to the gospel. Maybe your next step is to surrender your life to Jesus. Maybe like Zacchaeus, you sense Jesus saying to you, I see you, and I want to come to your life. I want to come and eat at your table. And your response is just to release what you've been clinging to instead of him. You can do that right now. If that's you, I just want you to write the words, yes, Jesus, on this sticker. Don't put your name, just put yes, Jesus. You see, the gospel is about a gift you receive. It's just saying yes. So write yes, Jesus. That'll be your prayer. And know that that will need to indicate a surrender of your life to him and receiving him as your Savior, trusting him. You can do that right now. So here's what we're gonna do. I'm gonna give you just a few moments between just you and the Holy Spirit to determine what your specific next step should be. That's all we're gonna do in the next few moments. On your way out, we're gonna ask you to take the sticker that you filled out and put it on the display in the lobby as a declaration of your faith. It's your stake in the ground of saying, I'm willing to do whatever it takes, and this specific thing is what God is calling me to next. You don't have to put your name on it. In fact, I would encourage you not to. Don't be scared, be honest and be bold. And how awesome is it out there to see all these people that are saying, this is what it means for me to take the next step. Take just a few moments right now. You give me a pen, give you a sticker. I want you to pray through this, seek the Spirit, fill this out, okay? It's all that's happening, which means if you're not doing it, everybody around is staring at you saying, I wonder why they worship Satan. That's what they're gonna be thinking right now, okay? So if you're not gonna do it, just act like you're doing it, okay? Just pull out, just, you know, doodle on it. That's what these moments are about. And in just a few minutes, our worship teams are going to come and they'll lead us to celebrate the generosity of Jesus.